This is FM 100.5 and 101.9. AM 1450, Rutherford County's place to talk. WGNS, Murfreesboro, your good neighbor station. This is The Truman Show with Truman Jones. A look at the politics, news, sports, and people that are shaping Rutherford County. Now your host, Truman Jones.
Good afternoon, Rutherford County. Got three great guests on today, and we're going to be talking about some pretty heart-wrenching things today that we all, it's one of those things that happened that we all can remember vividly many years ago. Have Mike Vincent on, and he, Mike is a writer and has been for a number of years in a number of organizations. He graduated from MTSU, and unfortunately, he's a resident of McMinnville, but we'll just slide on that one. And he writes a weekly column called Meat and Potatoes for the Murfreesboro Post newspaper. And Ron Fryer is here, too. Of course, everybody knows Ron, who owns a number of newspapers and has been the publisher of a number of newspapers and one of Charlie Morris's good friends. And we're going to talk about the alleged assassination of the Reverend Martin Luther King. And this is something that Mike has been working on for a long time. And we also have Dan Whittle, who is one of my good friends and is also writes for the Murfreesboro Post. Are we also including the Cannon County Courier in this?
Well, that'll be up to Ron. Including it is, hey, it's for the taking.
Mm-hmm. And as far as I'm concerned, if it's in the Cannon County Courier across Stones River, that makes it international.
Well, of course, you're listening to an author of great renown. Is that west of the Mississippi, Ron, or would you include that east of the Mississippi also?
I would say it's probably west of the Mississippi moving this way.
Yeah. Because yes. I haven't heard of anything yet. I mean,
well, we're all waiting with great anticipation the release of Dan's first book. It's the chronicles of
I underwhelm people with it. It may or may not happen in May.
Chronicles of Kanalu, Missouri, kind of a look back of what he experienced whenever he was growing up. So I'm sure that we will all have an opportunity to obtain an autographed copy of that book once the publisher releases it.
For a mere $15.
Yeah. I knew we weren't going to get it free.
No, there was no way that was going to happen free. Yeah. And yes, Mike does from time to time appear in the pages of the Cannon Courier as a contributor to that newspaper as well. So I've known Mike now probably better part of three decades and have followed him and his writing and have worked with him before. It was a really fascinating opportunity. Years ago, I was very privileged to have had a part of obtaining the last interview given by James Earl Ray for the Daily News Journal and the Morris newspapers from Franklin to McMinnville and Smithville at that time, and was able to get Pamela Harrison, who was our photographer, at the News Journal, and Mike in to the prison in Nashville.
That was a big coup.
It was a big coup to interview James Earl Ray. And he had been in a coma and had come out of a coma just long enough for us to get the interview for Mike to get there. And the News Journal at that time and the other Morris papers broke the last known personal interview with James Earl Ray before his death. Yeah. And that was probably, he died within the month after the interview.
You know, Mike, you kind of zero in on these things. You've also written a number of articles on the John F. Kennedy assassination, and what is it that takes you toward that direction as far as things that may be not exactly the way they are as it's been printed?
Well, some people would say it's a display of my nefarious dark side. I just find it entertaining. I find it engrossing, and it's complicated. And then with the Martin Luther King assassination and James Earl Ray, it was a matter of happenstance, fate. You know, as we said last year on the show, I just ran into Jerry one day. Just if we'd have been 10 minutes apart, it wouldn't have happened. At WT's Roadhouse and sitting there drinking a beer, and we just started talking. And that's actually was the birth of it.
Now, Jerry being
James Earl's brother. Mm-hmm. And not only his brother, he was his, James Earl saw fit to leave him his executor, his power of attorney, his partner in crime, and also, more so than anything, probably his one and only true confidant.
Well, let's go back over 40 years.
Okay.
To leading up to what they were doing. We're talking about James Earl Ray, what he was doing prior to the assassination, because I know that that's part of your story.
Right, and anything, you need a good, every good story has a good backstory. Mm-hmm. So the backstory on James Earl is he was born the eldest of 10 children in Alton, Illinois, March 10th, 1928. They were a dirt poor family, moved around a lot. James started committing crimes at an early age. By 1959, he'd already served three hitches, one for robbing a business office in Los Angeles, one for robbing a Chicago cab driver, and then these were in the late 40s, early 50s, and then he served at Leavenworth from 1955 to 1958 for being involved in a money order scam. Mm-hmm. And the reason it was Leavenworth, because they crossed state lines and doing it. Anyway, he was arrested in 1959 for the armed robbery of a Kroger store in St. Louis. And he entered the Missouri State Penitentiary. You know, the processing took a lot of time back then. Mm-hmm. He entered the Missouri State Penitentiary spring of 1960, and the Missouri State Penitentiary, also known as Jeff City and the bloodiest 47 acres in America, it was a rough place to do time. And he was there for 7 years, and he escaped April the 23rd, 1967. And how he escaped, they had honor farms, ranch and church honor farms, that grew and harvested fresh produce for the whole prison population. Right. And inside the main prison at Jeff City, they baked bread for the whole prison population, including the honor farms. Every day a truck would come in delivering fresh produce. The same truck would take out baked bread, and James hid in a bread box with a false bottom, punched holes in it, and got underneath the false bottom and covered himself in bread. And then when the truck was going down the road and sort of come to a slow stop, he hurled out the back into freedom. And he was a free man. I don't guess you could say free when you're a fugitive.
Did you find out how he planned that?
Not really.
He's pretty ingenious.
He was James. I wouldn't say was considered a mastermind criminal per se, but even his antagonists have said that he was quite canny at escaping. Mm-hmm. And you know, jumping around a little bit, he was the first person to ever successfully escape from Brushy Mountain. And he did that in June.
You got to be tough to escape from there.
June of 1977. Yeah. And in fact, he was in the middle of an interview with Playboy magazine when he escaped. And then when they caught him 54 hours later, they resumed the interview.
Now, that's amazing in itself.
Yeah.
But they did catch him. You know, the thing about escaping from Brushy Mountain is if you leave the facility itself,
what are you going to do when you get out
that's
there?
That's exactly right. It's almost like you're surrounded by nothing but hard country.
You'd better have some Rambo-like survival skills, because I've been up there.
Yeah, it's tough.
And I can talk about this openly now, because Jerry has talked about it openly. Jerry Ray, my friend, my collaborator on certain things, his brother, he was in on every one of these escape attempts. And in fact, when James did escape back in June of 1977. Jerry had buried a survival package for him. It was basically a duffel bag full of potted meat and ponchos, this, that, and other. I've got a list of it in that appendix right there. And what had happened when the authorities set up their command posts, they were near that area, and James just couldn't make his way over there. So he was on the loose for approximately 54 hours, and then he was brought back to justice.
Okay, and where did we go from there? Where did he go? And, of course, we remember the Alton robbery.
Right.
That was one of those pretty famous robberies at the time.
Right. And what happened there, as we said, James was born in Alton.
Mm-hmm.
Thus, he was familiar with their area.
And I was talking to Dan Whittle earlier, and he said that's about 40 miles from Chicago.
St. Louis.
Right.
It's right on the river on the other side of the Mississippi River from St. Louis.
So that's in the southern Illinois.
The Ray family, in their very early formative years, sort of shifted between Ewing, Missouri, Alton, and Quincy, Illinois, that area. And you got to remember, in Quincy, too, which is a short ways from Alton, it was wide open brothels. Jerry has told me just be streets and streets. One would be a gambling house brothel, to gambling house brothel, and that's sort of where James and Jerry sort of got their indoctrination to, I guess you could say, a world of crime.
Mm-hmm.
But going back to the Alton bank robbery, James had escaped April the 23rd, mm-hmm. 1967. Made contact with Jerry.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry was working at the Sportsman's Country Club in Northbrook, Illinois, which is a suburb of Chicago, about 20 miles outside.
Mm-hmm.
And James got a job in Winnetka, which is also a suburb of Chicago, close to Northbrook. Mm-hmm. And under an alias, obviously, he got a job washing dishes at the Indian Trails restaurant. Now, so James claims, his whole idea, see, you got to figure, he was 39 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
He had 13 years to go on this 20-year sentence for robbing the Kroger store, plus I think they were going to tack another 7 on for the escape. Mm-hmm. I think that's the number I've heard. So he was looking at another 20 years, which meant he would have been 59 or 60 when he got out. So he always claimed that he was trying to go to one of the English-speaking African countries, such as the Rhodesia or Belgian Congo, which they were called back then, no longer called that.
What was his reason for that?
Well, so he could get on with, like, the merchant marines and maybe escape and start a new life.
Okay.
And so, what we do know that the Alton Bank was robbed July 13th, 1967.
Mm-hmm.
Approximately $27,000 was taken by two masked gunmen. I've got the police report right there. James crossed over into Canada on July the 15th, 1967. And Jerry told me when James left that he didn't think that he'd ever see him again. And he said here he comes back in late August 1967. And they spend the night together. In fact, got a little chuckle out of this last time. Jerry met James at a little bar down by the Biograph Theater, ironically enough, where John Dillinger was shot down by federal authorities. And he said James was flush with cash, but said he'd been strapped when he went up there. And he said they went out and ate at Morton's, and I think I'll quote myself from last year, they procured a couple ladies of the night.
Now, this is a time after the Alton bank robbery. Now, they're broke now.
Well, no, when James comes back, the Alton bank robbery had happened. Jerry, as he tells me, James, when he went to Canada on July the 15th, 1967, which is only 2 days after the Alton bank robbery. Mm-hmm. So we got a timeline here that makes you furrow your brows just a little bit.
Right.
But he said when James came back, he was flush with cash. Mm-hmm. And when I say flush, he had plenty of money on him. He's buying him a hotel room, they're eating at Morton's, mm-hmm. you know, entertaining some ladies, this, that, and the other. And he, Jerry said the next morning there at Union Station, which is the main train station, mm-hmm. James gave him the keys to his car. Mm-hmm. And he said, from now on, when I contact you, I'll be using the alias Eric S. Gault or Eric Sturvogalt. And so now let's go back to the Alton Bank robbery, because that's part of our what we talked about. Mm-hmm. When the House Select Committee on Assassinations convened in the mid to late 70s to review the JFK, the RFK, and the MLK assassinations, mm-hmm. one of the founders of that group was Reverend / Congressman Walter Fauntleroy. He testified to it and told me personally, I was there the day he gave his testimony in Memphis, mm-hmm. he said that the House Select Committee was really bent on proving that the Ray brothers were in on the Alton Bank robbery, and thus that would have explained how James would have had the finances to have stalked and killed King.
Now, were they zeroed in to prove it one way or the other, or were they just kind of leaning more toward making sure that he himself had actually done the assassination?
I think my personal take is that they wanted to tie James Earl with it, because that would spell how he had the funds to stalk and kill King, and it would dispel his claim of this mysterious Raoul, who he said was his financier. But Jerry, when James was before the House Select Committee on Assassinations, you know, like you read in that piece, mm-hmm. the Reverend Fauntleroy answered that there was no evidence. The chief of police of Alton and the president of the bank said the Rays weren't suspects. And when James was on trial, and this was, you know, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, that was televised, Mark Lane was representing James, and he called Jerry. And Jerry went to the Alton Police Department with John Alba, who's a highly respected St. Louis media man, and he went there with a camera, and Jerry met whoever was in charge, a different guy, I'm sure, than from the time of the bank robbery. And again, I was filming this. This mm-hmm. can't be denied. And Jerry says, I'm here to turn myself in. And the officer in charge asked him, and I'm paraphrasing, what for? And Jerry said, for the Alton Bank robbery. And the officer asked him, said, are you admitting to it? And Jerry answered, I says, I can't admit to something I didn't have anything to do with. And he said, you never were a suspect. So with the
The media person heard all that and
has it on tape, John Alba, mm-hmm. For sure. I mean, that's a fact carved in rock. Now, where this gets a little murky and maybe distorted, the House, you hear, and I met her and I like her, but CNN did a special back in, it aired April the 3rd, 2008, called Eyewitness to Murder. Mm-hmm. Soledad O'Brien, lovely lady. She anchored it, mm-hmm. and did a brilliant job. I met her in person in McMinnville. Just a fantastic woman, ever since the word. But she said that in the Alton Bank robbery, mostly 20s were taken. Well, then she also, she had Captain John Light, who was one of the chief investigators of the Alton Bank robbery, mm-hmm. and he also said that mostly 20s were taken in the bank robbery. Okay, now let's...
They have direct knowledge that was accurate.
Well, okay, I'm getting to that.
Yeah, okay.
I'm trying to cut you short.
Oh, okay.
But James paid for, he bought a Mustang in late August, early September. So we're jumping around with our times just a little bit. Mm-hmm. He brought a Mustang, a 66 Mustang in Birmingham, Alabama, from a man named William Paisley for $1,995. Paisley was quoted as saying that James Earl paid him mostly in 20s. Mm-hmm. Okay, now let's go back to the mostly 20s claim. Mm-hmm. Okay, now let's look at it from a simple math perspective. Alton was a small-town bank, mm-hmm. did small-town business. Most transactions would have been for $1, $2, $5, $1,000. few for 10, a very, very few for 20. So tell me, what would a bank of that description in that time frame have mostly 20s on hand? It couldn't do business. It'd be like opening up business in 2012 with mostly 50s and 100s. You couldn't make change. Now, and then we go back to Captain Light's original police report. Mm-hmm. And nowhere in that police report, and you can read it, does it say anything about mostly 20s. Nowhere in that Time article does it say anything about mostly 20s. Nor is there any other media source that I've ever found that says mostly 20s.
Well, now, in the investigative report, not the offense report, but the investigative report, a lot of times they will try to pinpoint things like that are unusual. Was that not in the investigative report?
It was not in the investigative report, and that's exactly my point. You would have thought, be on the lookout for someone passing around a large number of 20s. Mm-hmm. And what I think happened is this. I think since James Earl, remember James, let's go back to the Mustang paying for most of the 20s. James mm-hmm. is born in Alton. The Alton bank job nets $27,000, split two ways, that's $13,500. Mm-hmm. Comparable to what, $100,000 in this day and time? Mm-hmm. So we want to paint a dark cloud over James Earl Ray. So if we can convince people that mostly 20s were used to pay for the Mustang, and he was in on the bank robbery, and it netted mostly 20s, then that explains, well, yeah, he was in on it, he was from there, and he had the funds necessary to stalk and murder King. But then here's your ringer. If James Earl Raisin, if he was such a venomous racist, mm-hmm. and he had this diehard desire to murder Martin Luther King, and so he's robbed the Bank of Alton, he's got $13,500, then why didn't he start stalking him from the get-go? Why did he go to Canada and stay for 6 weeks? I mean, he's evaded authorities. He can kick back and live large for a while. Mm-hmm. He can get on with the Merchant Marines, disappear, which was what he said he always wanted to do. But out of the blue, after 6 weeks, he just turns virulent racist and comes back to the States and foregoes all that and kills King. That just doesn't add up to me.
Did he have any tendencies at all prior to that you know of? By talking about discussing so many of his friends and family and things like that. Did he have any tendencies to show that he might end up doing something like that?
Not like that. No petty stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Break-ins, robberies.
You're talking about a number of people that would have been involved in a conspiracy that was aimed directly toward him. Is there any way to explain that or where maybe some of that could have come from?
As far as James Earl being like a pawn in a much broader conspiracy?
Right.
Well, he's a career criminal.
Mm-hmm. But why would he be the target? I mean, you're talking about a number of people. You're talking about the car dealer and the officer one of the other ladies, and probably even more than that, are all just parts of the puzzle that are leading toward him. It would almost have to been masterminded by somebody pretty powerful.
Well, and that's a thought. You know, there's no way to prove that.
Mm-hmm.
But James Earl Ray, I think how he could have ended up being a very low echelon variable in this much grander formula could have been, well, he was a career criminal.
Mm-hmm.
He was white. If he's not a racist, we can get somebody to claim he was a racist. Like mm-hmm. he told me, he said the only people that ever said he was racist were low lives like himself, who he'd done time with, who would say or do anything for a carton of smokes.
What he almost had himself set up was so much intrigue involved. You're talking about Raoul and the way that he just kind of set himself up away from all the people that knew him and took on a new identity pretty much on his own. He almost set himself up to start with.
It's a very complex thing, Truman, and I'll be the first to tell you that there are some holes in James Earl's story. But again, if you can set that his the holes in his story aside, and also set the holes in the story of the prosecution aside, and just whittle down, to use a pun here, mm-hmm. to whittle down the facts for what they are, it does not lead to him being the trigger man. And when I say that, I'm not trying to be an apologist for mm-hmm. him. That's just what I found. And talking about the aliases, mm-hmm. okay, from August of 1967 until James Earl Ray was picked up at London's Heathrow Airport on June 8, 1968, he used four aliases. He used the alias of Eric St. Vincent Galt, John Willard, Paul Bridgman, Raymond George Sneed. As we said, when he came back from Canada, he told Jerry, from here on out, when I contact you, I'll be using the alias Eric Starvo or Eric S. Galt. So he bought the Mustang under Galt. Mm-hmm. When he checked into Bessie Brewer's boarding house the day of the assassination, he used the alias John Willard. After the King assassination, he fled to Canada. He used the alias Paul Bridgman to rent a boarding house for a couple days. And then, while he was in Canada, he got a passport issued to him in the name of Raymond George Sneed, spelled S-N-E-Y-D. When James
Now, those are not easy to get, passports. No. So you're talking about he has four different separate identities, four or five.
But one passport. The only passport I can say for certainty was the Sneed, but I do know he used the other aliases. See, when he used Eric's, he did get a driver's license in the name Eric Starvo Gold in Birmingham, mm-hmm. Alabama. When he checked into Bessie Brewer's boarding house, that was like a low rent place for transit and street people, so he just gave her the name John Willard. Mm-hmm. He rented a place after the King assassination. I think it was on Ossington Street. It was in Toronto, under the name Paul Bridgman. Now, he did get a passport issued to him under the name Raymond George Sneed.
Now, where was he at that time?
He was still in Canada. It was just issued to him in Canada at the Kennedy Travel Agency, mm-hmm. where he got it at. But when he filled out the form, you know, Sneed, S-N-E-Y-D, mm-hmm. James didn't bring down the the stem of the small D, he didn't mm-hmm. take it up high enough, and it took on the character of a small A. Mm-hmm. So the passport originally was issued to him in the name of Raymond George Sneya, S-N-E-Y-A. Now, after he made his way into London, England, see, and this raises questions. How's he moving about this freely with 3,000 FBI agents looking for him, plus every other kind of security force that was an ally to America? So when he had, on one of his trips from London, England, to Lisbon, Portugal, mm-hmm. he had to check into the Canadian embassy, and one of the workers there had spotted this discrepancy mm-hmm. and the misspelling, mm-hmm. and they had issued him another passport. And when he tried, so he had two passports. One says Raymond George Sneed, S-N-E-Y-D. The other one says Raymond George Sneed, S-N-E-Y-A. He should have thrown that one away. Mm-hmm. When he was checking in at London's Heathrow Airport, he was bound for Brussels, Belgium. The ticket agent noticed the two passports. That piqued his curiosity, and that's when Scotland Yard was called in. He was arrested. But the point I want to make on the aliases is this. The ones we mentioned, Eric St. Vincent Galt, mm-hmm. Paul Bridgman, John Willard, Raymond George Sneed, all lived within a 5-mile radius of each other in Toronto, Canada. Hmm. They all bore striking physical resemblances to James Earl Ray. Now, the Galt character, which is really the main one, both he and James Earl Ray had scars on the palms of their right hands and on their right above their right eye on their forehead. Now, the Galt fellow worked at Union Carbide and had a high security clearance. His real name being Eric St. Vincent Galt, mm-hmm. what had happened, that's, you know, if you're signing signatures, especially in a supervisory position like he was in, that's a lot of writing, Eric St. Vincent Gault. So what he had taken to doing was writing it Eric, E-R-I-C, S-T with a period with a small circle around the period, V, and all to group together, V with a period in a circle, then Gault. And many believe, and I think it's a plausible assumption, that however Ray came into possession of this name, that he had visually misconstrued this abbreviation of St. Vincent for Star of Old, thus the Star of Old. And two, this Eric St. Vincent Gault was the only man of any such name in Toronto, Canada, as of 1967, 1968. To me, it defies basic logic to figure that a petty crook such as James Earl Ray could have located and obtained and successfully utilized such four such convenient aliases that bore physical resemblances to him and were located within that small area, that 5 mile radius. In fact, Gault, Snead and Bridgman lived within a 1.5-mile radius of each other. Willard was a little further out, but they all four lived within a 5-mile radius. And that, to me, is very troublesome. That, to me, reeks that he almost had to have some higher-level assistance. Now, I'm not saying it was...
Well, on that point, let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back with you while people are still on the edge of their seats.
Okay.
Do you have unfinished projects at your house? Perhaps your house is busting at the seams, but you're not ready to move yet. Or maybe you're ready to move, but don't know where to start. No matter what your situation is, we've got your solution. The Rutherford County Home Builders Association Home and Remodeling Show is Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, April 20th through 22nd at the Lane Agri Park on John R. Rice Boulevard. There will be companies representing every aspect of building, remodeling, or sprucing up your home. Again, that's April 20th, 21st, and 22nd at the Lane Agri Park on John R. Rice Boulevard. For more details, contact the RCHBA office at 890-8224.
This is Councilman Ron Washington, and I'm asking for your vote April 17th. I have proven my commitment to this community through volunteerism, service, and your trust. Serving a community is not just local involvement, it's regional and national. Experience matters. Vote Ron Washington, City Council. Early voting is March 28th through April the 12th. Election day is April 17th. I am Ron Washington, and I approve this message.
Okay, Murfreesboro, the quack is back. That's right, you heard it here first. The Ducks are back in town on June 23rd for the Sudsy's Car Wash Child Advocacy Center Rubber Duck Derby. We plan to float 10,000 rubber ducks down the Stones River, all to raise money for the Child Advocacy Center of Rutherford and Cannon Counties. $5 gets a duck entered into the race for a chance to win a $5,000 cash grand prize. Starting in May, you can adopt your ducks online at duckrace.com/Murfreesboro.
Hi, this is Mike, owner of Maple Street Grill, inviting you to check out our new website, online ordering, and download our iPhone and Android app at maplestreetgrill.com and just click on the icon to download it free to your phone. The Maple Street Grill at 109 North Maple Street in downtown historic Murfreesboro.
This is Good Neighbor Events, brought to you by AmeriCare Pest Control, the Rutherford Home Show, Saturday mornings at 11:30 on WGNS, and the Omni Hot Restaurant in Smyrna.
I've got AmeriCare is Rutherford County's number one choice in pest control, and it's simple to see why. After calling 893-7111, their staff came to my house 8 years ago when I had an insect problem. They looked at the situation, showed me the areas, and what they'd recommend to resolve the problem. After treatment and with quarterly checks, I'm bug, critter, and creepy crawly free. Thanks, AmeriCare.
Call the best of the best to get rid of your pest.
AmeriCare, 893-7111.
It's Wednesday, April the 4th, and we're in the middle of Holy Week. The downtown Murfreesboro congregations unite to celebrate Holy Week with a special lunch at 12 noon. Check our website under local events for the locations the rest of this week. And here in Murfreesboro, early voting is going on through April the 12th. Murfreesboro residents have an opportunity to vote for 3 city council members and 4 city school board members. Again, early voting is now through April the 12th. Now tonight at 5:30, they're honoring Jack Jolly by naming the baseball stadium at Oakland High School after him. You heard Jack yesterday on Truman Jones Show here on WGNS. He has done so much for the community. Once again, the naming of the Oakland High School baseball stadium is tonight at 5:30, and they're honoring Jack Jolly. There's a Red Cross blood drive on Thursday from 9 in the morning until 6 in the evening. That's over at the Red Cross office at 501 Memorial Boulevard. Thursday from 9 in the morning to 6 at night. And Godspell over at the Murfreesboro Center for the Arts, Friday and Saturday night at 7:30, and a Sunday matinee at 2. And those are Wednesday WGNS Good Neighbor events.
Slick Pig Barbecue. Down on East Main, there's pork, beef, chicken, and wings. Sauce too good to be true.
Now at Slick Pig Barbecue, try the catfish special. Wednesday night between 4 and 8 o'clock. $9.99 plus tax for all you can eat catfish. The meal includes hush puppies, white beans, and homemade coleslaw.
Slick Pig Barbecue, 1920 East Main.
The Truman Show now continues on the voice of Rutherford County, WGNS, AM and FM.
And welcome back with us. And we're going to continue on with Mike in just a couple of minutes. We just want to let you know that this portion of the show is brought to you by At Home Care. And that's Melissa Warren's business. And they come into your home 24/7, take care of all the responsibilities inside your home. And also, they run errands for you. They do everything that you have been doing all your life, and no longer you're able to do it. So you don't have to leave your home. They'll come in, take care of all of that for you. And all you have to do is give them a call at 713-4639 or pull them up on the internet, www.athomecaretennessee.com. And their place of business is At Home Care, and that's 237 Castlewood Drive, Suite H, and that's behind the Kroger's on Memorial Boulevard. Okay, Mike. Now, we have gotten into the part of complication. We're dealing with what I would consider an average-type guy. And here he is. He's traveling abroad. He's got all of these IDs that he's been able to take. He went into Canada first. And all of the trails have seemed to be lost from his brother here in stateside to Canada. And now he's coming back with all these IDs and a mysterious man by the name of Raul. And how in the world can somebody that's probably not any smarter than the four of us be able to accomplish all that without any prior knowledge of how to do it?
Well, again, it suggests that maybe he was being controlled by some type of more well-connected, established entity. You know, you could go many directions on that. Mm-hmm. You know, people have you know, said military, different governmental entities, any of those are possible.
But why would he be? Somebody like him, he's already supposedly a wanted man, and all of a sudden this particular person is singled out. Of course, we can go to John F. Kennedy assassination, and you have kind of a familiar scenario there. With Oswald, who supposedly assassinated Kennedy.
Those are some of the unknowns that do make it that much more intriguing. With James Earl, you know, to answer your question, why would this maybe more powerful group or groups, mm-hmm. why would they want James Earl? Right. Well, okay, he's a fugitive on the run. Mm-hmm. He's a four-time loser. He's white. If he's not a racist, we can establish him as a racist. And so he fit a profile, I think at least plausibly so, mm-hmm. he fit a profile that the American public would buy off on. Now, you know, that's an assumption, but I think that's at least a decent assumption.
Well, you know, a penitentiary or any type of penal institution has a wealth of knowledge inside of it from all the different people that are there that may not be your winning type people, but they have contacts all over the place. And when you were talking about that, I kind of go back to when he's in the penitentiary. It seems like everything started happening after that, after he escaped.
It did, indeed. For sure, as far as things being put into motion as it correlates with the King assassination, you're absolutely correct. It was less than a year later from the time he escaped, April 23rd, 1967, from Missouri State Penitentiary. Reverend King was slain April the 4th, 1968, in Memphis, Tennessee, and was in town to lead a march for the embattled sanitation workers, the majority of which were black. And by the way, while we're at it, today is the 44th anniversary of the assassination of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.
That's one thing it seemed to be lost in the past, is the reason why Martin Luther King Jr. was in Memphis. I think the embattled
sanitation workers.
Right.
And see, what had happened, you need to, we back up on that. He had already attempted to lead one march on March the 28th. Mm-hmm. And he had come to Memphis to lead this march at the request of Reverend James Lawson, who was a black Methodist clergyman in Memphis. Mm-hmm. And in fact, a good many of the Memphis black sanitation workers attended his centenary of Methodist Church. Mm-hmm. And I met Reverend Lawson. He's a very eloquent, seems to be sincere fellow. Mm-hmm. But King had come there at his request, and what had happened on the march that took place March 28th, 1968, mm-hmm. they were leading this march, we shall overcome, and it almost immediately went into chaos. There was windows breaking, this, that, and the other.
Now, where was that coming from?
This was downtown Memphis.
Yeah, but who was causing the ruckus?
Well, there was a group, it's been blamed on a group that was paid to do it, to disrupt King, to make him look bad. And I've read where it was a group called the Invaders. I can't really substantiate that, but mm-hmm. we do know there was a riot, mm-hmm. and everything turned chaotic. People are
being, that was during the march.
During the march, mm-hmm. almost immediately, they mm-hmm. King was leading the march. He had his arms were interlocked with his second command at the mm-hmm. Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Ralph Abernathy mm-hmm. and Julian Bond. Mm-hmm. And they were singing We Shall Overcome. Others were joining in, and it almost just went chaotic. When I say immediately, it was, that march was short-lived. Mm-hmm. Glass was flying, windows breaking, and in fact, many were beaten and jailed, and one young teenage black male, Larry Payne, was shot dead from a shotgun blast from a Memphis policeman. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, as far as who was at fault there, I can't say because I wasn't there, but right. we do know that there was one fatality from it. And what had happened, King was planning a second Poor People's March to Washington the latter part of April of 68. Mm-hmm. This one was going to be of the same design as the one in August of 1963, where he delivered his timeless I Have a Dream speech.
Right.
And that one drew right at 250,000 people. And mm-hmm. there were some concerns that this one could draw as many as 750,000 to a million. And you got to remember, too, we were still reeling from the Detroit riots of the summer of 67, which mm-hmm. still, I guess, are probably the worst riots to ever take place in America. So the reason King went back, and I've talked to some of his Southern Christian Leadership Conference people, mm-hmm. Hosea Williams, people like that. Mm-hmm. King's platform, his social, political, civil platform, I guess you could say, was nonviolence.
Right.
And his inner circle implored him not to go back to Memphis. Number one, they thought it would be dangerous. Number two, they said they were behind with the second Poor People's March. But he said, we must go back to Memphis because, he said, nonviolence is on trial.
Now, what was the purpose for the sanitation workers? What were they actually lobbying for?
They were lobbying for better working conditions, so it reads. Mm-hmm. They were paid for 40-hour work weeks only. Sometimes mm-hmm. they worked twice that much. No overtime, no benefits. Deplorable conditions, so they claimed. Mm-hmm. And what really spiked that into high gear, mm-hmm. in early February, two black Memphis sanitation workers, had this garbage truck that had the cylindrical-shaped barrel right. on the back. Mm-hmm. You throw in the garbage, and it churns and compresses it. Mm-hmm. And it was freezing cold rain. And for whatever reason, they chose to get into the back of the barrel.
Ooh.
To get out of the freezing cold, and somehow the barrel activated and it just churned and shredded them up into garbage, just like it would the garbage you throw in there. And that really upped the ante as far as the people being upset about the treatment of the garbage workers. So there had been a lot of trouble there. They'd been walking out and riding, but when these two garbage workers got killed, that really threw things into high gear.
Now, the sanitation workers were not unionized.
No.
Because you couldn't have a union if it working for the city or a government at that time.
The last speech that Martin Luther King made was, I've been to the mountaintop, and that was made in Memphis at this church the day before he was assassinated. Mm-hmm. So that speech, I've been to the mountaintop, was very prophetic, as it turned out.
Okay.
The assassination the next day.
Right.
Yeah, and in that speech, he says something to the effect of, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place, but I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory.
Yeah.
And that's that same speech Dan's talking about. And indeed, it was eerily prophetic.
Well, he definitely put himself at risk. And of course, he understood the risk that he was facing at that time. Now, all right, the riots occurred in Memphis.
Right.
And then how did it proceed from there?
Well, okay, after you are talking about after King was assassinated.
No.
Before. Okay. Right. Okay. After what happened after the riots on the initial march,
right.
March the 28th,
right.
Mayor Henry Loeb had an injunction against him coming back and doing it, but he worked that through his legal channels. Mm-hmm. And they got the injunction lifted. And so he landed in Memphis on April the 3rd.
And the injunction was, I presume, was for the protection of the area.
Yeah, right. And it was pretty heavy, too. I mean, you had National Guards roaming the streets and Jeeps and even some tanks.
I mean,
they were on red high alert. Mm-hmm. You would know more about that terminology than I would. Mm-hmm. But you had a heavy National Guard presence. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the injunction was lifted, mm-hmm. so King could lead another march. And he landed in Memphis on April the 3rd. There's two or three different dates given, but it appears that the march was actually going to take place on April the 8th. Mm-hmm. And he'd come in on the 3rd to make sure everything was in order. And on the evening of April the 4th, he and his entourage, basically fellow ministers in his Southern Christian Leadership Conference, such as Andrew Young was a member, mm-hmm. Jesse Jackson, Hosea Williams, and so on, they were the evening of April the 4th, 1968, they were staying at the Lorraine Hotel and Motel, which, by the way, now is the National Civil Rights Museum.
Okay, now let's hold up. We're going to have to take a quick break.
Okay.
And then we'll be right back.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Chris Bratcher, Vice Mayor of Murfreesboro. I'm running for City Council, and I'm committed to make sure that Murfreesboro provides great jobs for us, our children, and our grandchildren. Did you know over the past 24 months, Murfreesboro has created 1,800 great jobs for our citizens? If you want to keep Murfreesboro moving forward, then I ask for your vote and your support for Chris Bratcher. Murfreesboro is a great city, and I want to continue to make Murfreesboro a great place to live, work, and to play. I am Chris Bratcher, and I approve this message.
The new Powerball is being described as bigger, better, more. But we wanted to be crystal clear on what bigger meant. So we asked a lottery spokesperson to clarify bigger for us.
The jackpots now start at $40 million and grow quicker than ever.
And that's bigger than before?
Yes, it's actually twice as big.
Which makes it twice as fun. Play the new Powerball today. Bigger jackpots, better odds, more millionaires, just $2. Tennessee Lottery, game-changing fun.
So what does it take to tame Tennessee's $3 million megatraction?
Well, I crack the whip, and Hugo here runs in and scratches the $3 million mega cash ticket.
I scratch the ticket.
Yes, he scratches.
Only Hugo scratches.
I scratch.
Hugo usually scratches, but anyone can scratch.
$3 million top prize. 10 prizes of $1 million or more. The most exciting megatraction in Tennessee is ready to be tamed. Play the new $3 million mega cash instant game today. Tennessee Lottery. Game-changing fun.
The local conversation continues now on The Truman Show. Once again, here's Truman Jones.
Welcome back with us. And Mike, continue on because we're running short of time. I want to make sure we get most of this in here.
Okay, another thing I'd like to talk about that has been conveniently overlooked by many politically correct primetime media sources, the death slug. Okay, King was killed with a 130-06 bullet. It was a Peters Corlock 150 grain. The bullet now is in three fragmented pieces at the Civil Rights Museum. Memphis homicide detective Barry Linville, who was highly respected, old school cop. He testified and told me personally that he was in the autopsy room with Shelby County Coroner Dr. Jerry Francisco when he extracted the bullet from King's corpse. He said it was in, quote, pristine condition. Ballistically speaking, on a scale of 1 to 10, he would have given it a 9. So vivid were the landing groove markings that they would have no trouble whatsoever either matching the death slug to the alleged murder rifle or excluding it from the same. He said, we felt like we'd found, quote, a piece of gold. Okay, now, Gerald Posner says in his book, and of course, Posner's his own thing. You can figure him out for yourself. But to let you know, he gets fired from plagiarism from the Daily Beast, which is owned by the Miami New Times. But he's basically known as a government type writer. He did a book in 1998 called Killing the Dream. Okay. In a footnote on page 272, he said he talked with Robert Frazier, who at that time was the FBI's top ballistics man. In fact, he conducted the ballistics on the rifle that Oswald allegedly used to kill Kennedy. Frazier, so says Posner, but I wouldn't want to point a finger at Agent Frazier until I had a chance to talk to him in person. But Posner quotes him as saying that he was the reason the bullet got fragmented under certain stress testing ballistically. That's right. I get that same raised, lowered eyebrow look from everyone that it fragmented. He's the one responsible for it fragmenting. Now, the FBI conducted their test on it April the 5th, 1968, after the assassination, which would be protocol. Okay, now, Barry, so let's do a timeline here. Barry Linville sees Dr. Francisco extract the slug on the 4th after King was shot and brought to the morgue, autopsy room. It's in pristine condition. He said there was just a very slight flattening of the nose. Of course, it's a soft tip. And a scale of 1 to 10, he rated it a 9. Okay, now, so according to Posner, Agent Frazier told him he was the one responsible for it fragmenting on the 5th into three pieces, which it now is in three fragmented pieces. So you think, well, there's a possibility that maybe when Linville saw it on the 4th, it was in one whole piece, but this is 24 hours plus later. It could have fragmented. Now let's bring in James's original defense counsel, the father and son team of Arthur Haynes Jr. and Sr. Mm-hmm. Arthur Haynes Jr. testified that when James Earl Ray was extradited back from England to Memphis to stand trial, which was July the 19th, 1968, he landed at Millington, Naval Base in mm-hmm. Memphis. He had access to all the evidence. That's over 100 days after this FBI ballistics analysis. Mm-hmm. He said, I held the bullet and it was in one whole piece.
Mm.
And he basically echoed what Linville said. He said it was as good an evidence bullet as you could have. It says the striations were visible to the naked eye. So my question is, as I sort of hinted in this last column, mm-hmm. just when and why did the bullet go from one whole piece intact in pristine condition on a scale of 1 to 10, a 9, to 3 fragmented pieces? And I find that worrisome.
Now, the .30-06.
.30-06.
Where was it ever located, the .30-06?
Oh, yeah, it was taken out of King's body. You mean the rifle?
The rifle.
The rifle, yes. The rifle was found, the alleged murder rifle was found wrapped in a green bundle in the doorway of Knapp's Amusement, which was a few doors down from Bessie Brewer's, from whence the prosecution claims James Earl shot King.
Was there ever a comparison with that rifle?
There's been 3 ballistics tests conducted, and all 3 were inconclusive.
Hmm.
The FBI conducted theirs on April the 5th. The House Select Committee conducted it in the 70s. That was inconclusive. The most recent one, which is probably the most interesting one, was when Judge Joe Brown, now of television court fame, was over the case. Much to the chagrin of the Memphis prosecutors,
mm-hmm.
he ordered a third round of retesting. They fired 18 bullets through the alleged murder rifle. Quote, 12 of the 18 bullets fired through the murder rifle, alleged murder rifle, had landing groove markings dissimilar with a D
mm-hmm.
to a portion of the slug they could still get striations from.
Mm-hmm.
The other 6 bullets, they couldn't tell one way or another ballistically. Judge Joe said that, he told me this personally, he said that in itself demanded yet a confirmation testing, the 4th round. That's when the Tennessee Court of Appeals pulled him off the case and said that he had lost the ability to act as an impartial judge and was biased in favor of James Earl Ray.
Now, did anybody ever link James Earl Ray to a weapon?
Yeah, yes.
Was it that one that they were
that
using?
Alleged murder rifle he admittedly bought, he claimed he handed it over to Raul on the 3rd cover as part of an arms transaction. He went into Arrow Marine Supply in Birmingham, Alabama, April the 29th, and brought a 243 Winchester.
Mm-hmm.
The next day, he went back and swapped the 243 for this .30-06 Remington Game Master pump action.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, one theory is that if the shooter already was in place and James Earl was being handled, and the shooter was going to use a .30-06, and it was necessary to leave a trail of James Earl right handling the .30-06. Of course, a counter argument could be, well, if they're that much together, why didn't they have him get a .30-06 from the get-go? You know, mm-hmm. so there's a lot of those kind of questions can come into play.
You know, the thing about all these conspiracies that it's really fascinates me is, why do they always have to have a scapegoat in these? Because if people are smart enough to plan something, all they're doing is just putting one other person into play, and you never know what's going to happen with something like that. And it just puzzles me why you have that other step. Because in
yeah.
those type of master crimes, you want to make it as simple and as uncomplicated as possible.
Yeah. Following up with that, it's amazing what would have happened had James Earl Ray not admitted or confessed, mm-hmm. rather, confessed to the crime.
Yeah.
Which he tried to recant multiple times after that.
Just one little interjection on that, he entered a guilty plea.
Yes.
Entered a guilty plea.
It was kind of the same thing.
Which he did. And then you got to go back to why he entered a guilty plea. He they knocked out at the Shelby County Jail. They knocked out a wall that divided two cells and made one large room. And he told me this, and Jerry said it, that they had these bright lights, almost flood-like lights on him 24 hours a day. Couldn't use the restroom in privacy. You know, there's an issue
like a prisoner
of
war,
an issue of sleep deprivation. Yeah. And I've got a photocopy in there from the Memphis Press Skimter. It says James Earl Ray will be monitored 24 hours a day. So we have an issue of sleep deprivation, dementia. And James often said that had he been his right state of mind, that he would not have entered a guilty plea. And then you got to bring in his lawyer who had him enter the guilty plea, Percy Foreman, though great as he was somewhat of a dubious character himself.
1968 was kind of a turning point, a big turning point, in fact, for America. Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson said he would not run. That was the beginning of the end of the Vietnam War. So 1968 was a pivotal year for American history.
That's almost an understatement, Dan. It was maybe the most pivotal year that I can remember.
One of them, yeah.
And then you had Woodstock to follow shortly after that.
Yeah.
Well, I think we put a lot in the minds of the people out there today. And this is one of those situations that you almost just, each person has to take that information and just make up their own mind.
They do.
Will we ever know 100% sure? Will we mathematically know that?
We won't know, because if it was that well schemed a plan, it's not planned out for us to know. Mm-hmm. And I always challenge people to do this. Don't necessarily believe me. Don't necessarily believe the opposition. Do your own research and decide for yourself. Before I forget, if people are interested in this, there is a book available that gives you a good short, gritty read on Jerry's take about his brother. And the name of the book is A Memoir of Injustice, written by Jerry Ray, brother of James Earl Ray, and Tamara Carter, a well-known historian researcher. And you can purchase it at Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, or just any general bookstore. If you have the title, they can hook you up.
All right. Been a great show, Mike.
Same here.
Ron.
Thank you, John.
Dan. It's always good to have you guys on. You're a lot of fun. Enjoyed lunch today. And for those of you who would love to, Jack Jolly, they're dedicating the stadium at Oakland Baseball today at 5:30. And all of the former players and people who just admire Jack like I do, come on over. We'll have a good time today. If it starts raining, we'll be in the cafeteria. If not, we'll be at the ballpark. See you tomorrow.